This is another live radio link up brought to you by the Government Communications GCIS.
It is a very good evening and welcome to it. We are live to you in KwaZulu-Natal, broadcasting from Pretoria in South Africa. My name is Sean Munahudzi and we are doing Let's Talk Justice once again. Compliments of the brand new year. And of course, we're continuing our discussion looking into sexual orientation, gender identity, expression and sex characteristics, which is SOGIESC matters. And basically, we need to start from the understanding point of view of understanding different people's orientation, gender identity, or how they identify themselves, the expressions, and of course the characteristics thereof. I will not be doing this alone. I will be joined on the line by a guest, Ms. Lindi Letoala, who is the legal admin officer at the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the KwaZulu-Natal Regional Office, and will be joined by Nonhlanhla Mkhize, the National Task Team member for KwaZulu Natal. So you do know our office, not office line, our call in line is 0800 142 446. So we do invite you to participate in this program. This program is for you. This program is about you. This program is about getting a better understanding of each other as citizens of the country and understanding the dynamics of the world and the times that we live in. What are the objectives, though, to really look at to highlighting the efforts that are going into ensuring protection against violence and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, expression and sex characteristics, and also looking into educating our communities on the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons and the promotion of acceptance towards the LGBTQI plus persons, and also looking into creating awareness on the work of the national task team and the provincial task teams, and also looking into letting communities know about the national intervention strategy for the LGBTQI plus sector, which is a human rights survivor focus and victim centric approach in countering discrimination, hate crimes, gender-based violence, femicide, which is perpetrated against people on the basis of the sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, and characteristics. Let's welcome our guests on the line. We'll start with Slindile. Slindile, good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be in the studio this evening to educate and raise awareness on SOGI matters and the human rights of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex, in brief, which is the LGBTQI plus person.
Indeed. We are also joined on the line by Nonhlanhla Mkhize, a national task team member in KwaZulu-Natal. Nonhlanhla, good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening to you and to your listeners, and thank you very much for having us on the show.
All right. Now, let's. We're going to start dealing with the letters first before we get very deep into the program, because, I mean, I was just having a chat beforehand to say, I think over time, the letters have either changed or evolved or been adapted to reflect the times of the day. And today we're talking about, I think, this new letter, SOGIESC, is S-O-G-I-E-S-C matters. Let's start with you, Slindile. Let's talk about what is LGBTQI A plus, and has it changed? Why did it change? And also this new term we're learning about today of orientation, identity, expression, and characteristics.
Okay, the LGBTQI plus, it stands for, L stands for lesbian, and G stands for gay, B stands for bisexual, T stands for transgender, Q stands for queer, and I stands for intersex, and then you have your plus. And then with the SOGIC SC, it stands for sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics.
All right, I think I get you. But now I think we need to take this back right to the beginning. I mean, I want some time to be explained to, like, I was 5 years old, to get a deeper understanding of the concepts we are talking about, because these are concepts that we need to create awareness and understanding with different communities. Let's talk to you, Nontlantla. It's been described what the letters mean, but can we delve deeper when you say, instead of just saying this person is gay, what does it mean to be lesbian? As opposed to being transgender or to being queer or being intersex? Because people can use these terms interchangeably and maybe in a confusing manner. Maybe if we could break us down for so to understand how then to better identify.
Sure. So I think as you sort of initially put it in your introduction, these are primarily terms that at most times we've adopted insofar as language use is concerned. So I know if this show were done in vernacular, we would really have struggled.
Yes.
Because of the mere fact that these are very much borrowed terms insofar as they come from a context that is psychological, gender, insofar as academia is concerned, but also insofar as the language that is about human rights. So, I mean, when we talk about lesbian, gay, and bisexual, we're really talking about what is enshrined in our constitution insofar as the equality clause, sexual orientation, that we are people that should not necessarily be discriminated against on grounds of who we are attracted to. So being bisexual would basically mean one is attracted to both male and female sexes, mm-hmm. whereas a lesbian would ideally be a female-bodied person that is attracted to both. Of the same sex, and the same applies when you talk about gay, that you're primarily referring to male-bodied or men that are attracted to other men. So it's very specific, very precise, but at the same time, I think what comes out of the concept of talking about sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics is us therefore being a little bit more inclusive and us being more understanding at this point in our lives that while in a particular context we understood being gay, being lesbian, being bisexual as almost boxed and specific, that actually when it comes to human identity and attraction, these are prisms that perhaps are not cast in stone, as we say that. But simply put, really, the two expressions, so the SC and LGBTI, really has a lot to do with sexual orientation, gender identity, so far as transgender, where it would have been a country and a community that understands the identity, gender, as men and women. But ours is, but what happens to us that are perhaps born a particular, assigned a particular sexual identity at birth, and yet how we live our lives is such that we see ourselves and experience, visualize ourselves as the opposite gender. So once again, it is identities and articulations in language that time has brought us here. And I think with SOGI SC, the understanding is there's just so much more to a person than is in name. And finally, intersex, really talking about individuals who at birth are difficult to have assigned male or female as it is in our birth certificate. And as a result, we've made the exception to say perhaps there's more ways of identifying than just the status quo and just what has been seen as the norm because of our diversity and so far.
Indeed. No, I'm still with you on that.
Yeah, that's where intersex is at. And I think the plus is really the recognition that there is more to sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics than what meets the eye. And I think really for the listener at home, it's just a reminder that, you know, normally when a child is born, we tend to be a community and practitioners that look between the legs. And ours is so much more to a person than what meets the eye, than what you see between the legs.
Indeed, there's no better explanation than that. I think from what you just did for us, now we have a better understanding that these are not just terms that are interchangeable, that can be thrown or bandied about. There is a particular descriptor that is used for a particular reason. And if you also want to participate, we have an open line, 0800-142-446. And then you can call us in and send us your questions, and also hit our social media platform, Facebook, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and on Twitter, it's at DOJCD_ZA. Now, let's talk to you, Ms. Twala, to say the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development has been very heavily involved in pushing awareness in communities. Why is it particularly this department, say, as opposed to social development or maybe home affairs, that is really pushing this education and this this awareness in these matters? Oh, I think we've lost Lindile. We have lost Lindley, so we still have... Okay, fine. I think we'll continue with you, Nwantlantla, and I think I'll just pose it slightly different. Let's talk about where we are as a country right now. I think before we move forward, what is the status quo in terms of the understanding and the protection of the rights of the members of the LGBTQIA plus community?
Our protection primarily in a country like South Africa is derived from the concept human rights as enshrined in the South African Constitution under Chapter 2, Bill of Rights, and of course Section 9, the Equality Clause, where there's the expression about the fact that neither the state nor an individual citizen has the right to unfairly discriminate against the other. And it mentions a variety of grounds, but it specifically articulates sex, gender, and sexual orientation. And, of course, that's really where it all starts. And then what you see over time is that we've got quite a number of legislation that has been enacted from angle where you're looking at us being seen as people that actually are in relationships that are equal to family. To an extent where we're talking about being able to adopt, being able to have our partners on our medical aid for those that can afford to, when it comes to issues around gender-based violence or even domestic violence, the recognition that we are in relationships that may be subject to violence, even between us as individuals of the same sex or in transgender relationships and identities. So in legislation, in policy, therefore, we find ourselves in a situation where there's been quite huge advancement. Regrettably, when it comes to where we are in a societal perspective, we find ourselves being people who are unfortunately still subject to severe levels of discrimination. And I think the terms coined in the recent past, hate crimes, really speaks to what we're experiencing quite more frequently, where we find a lot of us being kicked out of our own families, at times thrown to death, if not violated sexually and beaten up or cast aside and rendered marginalized just because of who we are insofar as sex identity and gender identity, but also insofar as who we are likely to be in relationships with, where it may be people of the same sex or where one is transgender, where, as indicated earlier on, I'm perhaps assigned female at birth, I live my life as a man, perhaps I'm attracted to a woman and date a woman, and upon being discovered find myself being subject to violence because someone hates who they think I am, or the mere fact that I'm subscribed to the group transgender or even LGBTI or queer.
Indeed. I think we've got Slindile on the line. Slindile, I think we're getting a sense that there is a societal perspective which says that we have a long way to go as society because there is heinous hate crime still being perpetuated against members of the LGBTQIA+. And then now, as a department, you've basically engaged on this program to do talk shows and create understanding. How important is the department as role in promoting the human rights? And also, why is it your department running with this instead of maybe social development or any other department?
I think for the Department of Justice, it is important because our main role is to implement, respond, and prevent the sex and gender-based violence crimes committed against the LGBTI plus persons. Also, as a department, we are trying to strengthen the government's ability to respond to the needs and specific vulnerabilities of the LGBTI persons. Also, we are trying to strengthen the capacity of the civil society organizations, the CSOs, to deliver related services to the LGBTIQ plus persons. Furthermore, we are not working in isolation as a department. We are working with other departments where we are improving the linkage with other departments, which include programs within the DOJ, such as access to justice.
Understood. Manje, masikhulume-ke and then take it further and look into the idea of sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics. When I see it, it actually can be broken down into the different sections it is. There's the idea of sexual orientation, there is the idea of gender identity, there is also expression, and also so sex characteristics. I think this is now the focus where we want to go to. Now, these programs of now looking into this, what is the intention here of taking us to understand the differences between sexual orientation, gender identity, and also what are the differences between the orientation, the gender identity, the expression, and the characteristics? Nontlanhla, are you still with us?
Sure, I'm still here.
The issue of the SOGIESC to say, we are now breaking it down and getting to the bottom of it. What's now are the differences between the orientation itself, the gender identity, the expression, and the characteristics so that people can have a broader understanding of the matters?
I think earlier on when one was introducing or at least speaking a little bit into the different identities or definitions in the
yes.
terminology is concerned, when we're trying to get at is, for instance, when we talk expression, the aspect that how we are assigned our sexual identities is best. The reference I made earlier on that, you know, we're still a country and practitioners that are lucky to first look at what's between the legs and then say, you know what, because of what you have, then you therefore shall be assigned a particular sexual identity. That's before you've been allowed a chance to grow up, discover your own self and express yourself the way that you want. And this expression could be in the way you speak, could be in the way you dress, could be in the way you carry yourself. It could be the way you address yourself. And too many times, and I think this relates to a case we had in Cape Town, 2004, a young girl where a group of boys in the neighborhood asked her, so you're a tomboy. And her response was very much, no, I'm not a tomboy, but I'm a lesbian. It was her way of expressing how she sees and views herself. And based on that, and their own understanding of what lesbian could potentially be, she found herself being stoned to death literally a few meters away from her own home. Now, that's just one way that we find how we express who we are becoming a challenge and a result or what becomes a reason for somebody else to therefore discriminate against us and even go as far as violating and killing us. But what you see as well when it comes to us accessing services is that if I'm someone who finds sexual identity female at birth, or maybe let me use a different example, I find male at birth, of course, some of my characteristics as I grow up might be a bit predominant, and therefore how I'm dressed might be such that as I approach a facility, perhaps a clinic, perhaps even safety and security to report that I've been violated in a particular way, that the person that receives me looks at me, judges me from how they see how I've expressed myself in dress, or perhaps in how I speak. Immediately with that comes the response that is either negative, and if it is not negative in words, it's negative in doing. So the concept of expression, how we express ourselves and how we violate it and therefore subject to discrimination and prejudice because of how we express ourselves is where that comes in. Sex characteristics, as indicated, is still very much a country that looks at what's between the legs to judge you, looks at what's between the legs to figure out whether I want to be in a relationship with you or not. And should it be that I'm assigned male at birth, live my life as a woman, because that's who I am, you and I meet up at the Shifanyama somewhere, you find an attractive woman, take me out. And then it turns out that, hey, my sexual characteristics are not necessarily aligned to what you thought would be because of what you saw. What happens in that private space? You are likely to abuse me, violate me, not kill me. So these are the traits that Isophysiology SC and therefore the work of the task team on hate crimes is responding to the very same violation that is as per how we perceived, how we understood, just because of who we are in so far as identity, expression, but also what we have no control over, our own sexual characteristics.
That was actually very thorough. I actually have now a better understanding of the matters that you can actually break it down further. It's not just what's above the surface. I think Slindile has also joined us back on the line. Now, I think it's also important to also look into the work, the role and the mandate of the National Task Team, because it's been referred to in this conversation once or twice. I think we've lost Slindile once again. But you are a member of the Provincial Task Team, Nontlanta. What is the National Task Team and what led to its establishment?
So basically the history is, and I think when it comes to the case I mentioned earlier on in Cape Town, yeah, it was 2004, where we start documenting instances where an individual has been subject to a barbaric response to who they are, or how they identify, or how they express themselves. But what you see happening in South Africa is 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, quite a rise in instances that we refer to as hate crimes. And I think what brought us to where we identified the formation of the task team was having understood, coming from an LGBTI perspective, a civil society, as activists on the ground, people defending the rights of LGBTI, that, hey, so many cases are going to court, or at least are being reported with SAS, but they're not making their way to court. And should they be making their way to court, even the sentencing that you get just doesn't give you the idea that, you know what, this person needed to be given that sentence. In other words, from where we located, it deserved a harsher sentence. I mean, if you're going to take some child's life and act as barbaric, and please excuse the example I'm going to make, but where you put them into pieces. In fact, even before you do that, incidences that we've had in KZN, a child was raped first, chopped into pieces, dumped into a public toilet, and still burned. to have that level of hate and still have that case going in and out of court and not necessarily giving us a harsh sentence, but like a 15-year sentence, it's a slap in the hand, and it gives an ordinary member of the LGBTI community the indication that, you know what, our lives are not taken seriously, our lives do not matter. So the petition to the presidency 2011 led us to a situation where the Office of the President assigned the Department of Justice this task to say, look, this is about people having confidence in the justice system of South Africa. And what best way to do it than to have a specific task team whose job is to make sure that these matters are monitored, that where incidences have been identified, they are reported and actually are in the system, followed through to an extent where there is a judgment on a matter, and if it means sentencing. So this has really been primarily our task as the national task team. And of course, you had alluded to it in the introduction, that there's also what they call the rapid response team, which really is very much about fast-tracking those incidences, because we know the wheels of justice is really slow. So the question is, how then do you speed up that process as best as possible? So this is how then, it might sound like it's two different task teams, but it's actually a rapid response team within the task team as set up since March 2011, to specifically make sure that these incidences are reported, that the cases are in the system, that they are thoroughly and specifically and closely monitored, but that ultimately justice is served.
Now, just to talk about then the rapid response and the work they've done since 2011, has there been then an increase in the arrest, the prosecution and the sentencing of perpetrators of hate crimes and GBV crimes, specifically to people of the LGBTQI community?
So we've had some, and I'm hoping I got the questions right, but we've had some success insofar as cases that have been officially reported and monitored and have gone through our courts. And yes, deserving sentences have gone into them. But it's unfortunate that there's quite a lot of others that have not. And as a result, you may be aware that quite recently, at least the past 2 years, South Africa is going through a process in time where we are developing, or at least have developed, what is called the Prevention of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill, currently before Parliament. And of course, a bit of engagement has happened within our communities to try and make sure we fully understand what this means and how it would help us with, one, the crime rate as it affects LGBTI, but also making sure that the sentencing does consider the fact that the motive had hate in it. It wasn't just, by chance that I found myself being assaulted or found myself being robbed, but that the person's motive was, you gay, and I want to teach you a lesson. You transgender, I'm going to show you what we do to people like you. So there has been some positive spin-offs. There's been, unfortunately, quite a number of those cases where we, and I guess that's where the intervention strategy then comes in, because it focuses on more than just monitoring the cases. It's about educating communities and trying to get us to at least prevent the crimes before they happen.
Understood. I can see that there's been definitely movement since the intervention team came into place. Now, you know, there's many practical examples that or questions that I like to bring into to the fore just to make this very practical. Now, I'm looking at the Department of Home Affairs. Now, how has Home Affairs come on board in assisting people that want to get identity books and birth certificates and that will identify them correctly? At this point, is Home Affairs on board that you can walk in and then get your ID or birth certificate and have your gender assigned correctly? Do they have those systems? And you then will move on to other public services like, you know, healthcare. Are they inclusive? The South African Police Service, when we report cases now, is there the sensitivity that is required to take down sensitive cases of GBV, of femicide, of hate crimes, just with those two. Let's just start there.
Sure. So on paper, unfortunately, that's where most countries are unfortunately held back at. But on paper, South Africa has quite beautiful policies that have really given you a sense that we have advanced. If you just had to judge us according to that, we're really one of the best in the country so far as the protection and promotion of the rights of all people, including LGBTI. However, we need to remember as well that the people that are providing services, these civil servants, are human beings too.
True.
And while systems might have been put in place to make sure that they are standing orders, there are memos that basically and guidelines in certain contexts that are supposed to assist you to do your job better as a person employed or in the employ of government. We are aware that there would be someone in KZN that would go to a local Department of Home Affairs as an individual identified as transgender to say, I want to have my gender marker changed and not get the service. And yet somebody else in Gauteng goes to Home Affairs, exactly the same service, gets it done. It's the same department, same procedures, except that the person on the implementing those procedures.
So the attitudes of officials is what differs.
So we do have issues with the attitudes of the professionals or the service provider. And I think that's where our job so far as members of the task team, either as civil society, as government counterparts, or even as business, our job has to be that about making sure that those that are not delivering as expected are brought to book. They themselves, if it's in the sense capacity issue, can build their own capacity because ultimately we want the person to be able to access services. So yes, the National Task Team has already, I think you might have articulated it in the beginning, but just in case you did not, I think we sort of brought it to a fore as well, that it may be led by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, but the partners within government that are there supporting include Home Affairs, include Education, include Department of Health, your SAPS, your Correctional Services, your domestic, what you call it, your Department of Social Development,
yes,
and quite many others. So at that level, I mean, there's been quite a number of pieces of work that we've put together to make sure that we are bringing about change as our intervention strategy. But I think it's important, and I think this is what we've been as civil society members of the task team also communicating with our own people to say, please be reminded that while change is coming, it is not going to happen overnight. Just as much as we're expecting from our government counterparts, civil servants to do, we ourselves need to make sure that we are fully educated about what our rights and what is available to us, so that we don't demand what the country has not necessarily been able to put on the table yet. So there is that work on our side, and of course, there is that progress working with the Department of Home Affairs. I mean, the challenge I know that is quite major for us when it comes to social services is accessing shelters. If I'm a person that has discovered them, I'm a teenager, I tell my parents, mom, dad, I'm gay, I'm likely to be thrown out on the streets and far more vulnerable to many other criminal activity than I would have been at home in the comfort of my family that supports me. So there are still that many other issues. So it is our hope that through this partnership, that we will not only just deal with issues as they affect us insofar as criminality, but really all other aspects of what makes us feel secured, protected, and our livelihoods promoted within the country as enshrined in the Constitution unfold.
I mean, we do agree that the government's job is to govern us as a society, but also as a society, the fact that we need governance means that we behave in ways that are of our own. And why I'm saying this, we have in society, we have created religion. or we have religion. And religion is the elephant in the room when we're talking about sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics. It is an elephant in the room because quite a lot of, I don't know how to put it without being blasphemous, but a lot of the concepts that are found in religion are against any type of relation beyond the binary, as we would, if we were to call it that. Now, what work are we doing there? Because as much as it's not government, its influence is very deep and it goes far and wide. And its religion, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Islam, they've got particular stances that, of course, are not consistent with the Constitution. And as much as we said on paper, policies are great, but in the society we live in, the churches have got bigger influence.
Sure. I guess a closer look at the intervention strategy, the National Intervention Strategy, NIS, it is referred to within our spaces, is that pillars are such that it's not just about recording, monitoring, and fast-tracking cases, having a data system that sort of helps us monitor all of these. It also, as indicated earlier on, about making sure that we are doing prevention work. And of course, prevention work basically means a lot of education has to happen. And with education is the fostering of partnerships with other civil society structures. For example, the one that we're talking about, the refugee sector. So there's a lot of work happening behind the scenes that includes working with the religious sector, traditional leadership, traditional healers, insofar as how they themselves, what their role is, insofar as creating an enabling environment for LGBTI to be fully who they are. Of course, it's not that work that we're going to accomplish perhaps not in our lifetime, but at least the seed is being planted and to our I mean, where we are right now, we've had quite positive strides. If we look at some of the concrete dialogue that we've had with leadership from the religious sectors, traditional sectors, and even those of traditional leaders, healers. So it gives you a sense that bit by bit, we're going to get there. It's just not going to happen immediately. And I think where we are at with them now as leaders and our counterparts is challenging them to speak a little bit more openly about where they stand when it comes to the concept of respecting and protecting human dignity and the realization of this thing called equality for all. I mean, it can't be only the likes of the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu that within the people of the cloth, we would have a leader that stands up and literally says, I will not go to a heaven that is such that LGBTI are not allowed into. So it's quite, or I will not praise a religious leader or a god that is discriminatory. So we need more, and I know in his passing, we've also used that space to say, so many of you, please come out, please speak out, because only when they do, as our partners, would we start to see change.
Indeed. Now, you know, also, when you now look into our black communities and you take it back and you really dig deep, you find that different sexual orientations, different gender identities and expressions and characteristics have always existed, albeit it was something that was either kept away from the masses, but it's something that has always been a part of us. So I'm trying to understand where the hate comes from, because it almost sounds like there is a denialism that there are some members of communities that are different from what you would do. And this has been since a time immemorial. Do we have denialism as people and try to sweep things under the carpet as if they don't exist when they've been with us since a time immemorial?
Difficult one, and I think from a Justin perspective, I may not necessarily be able to respond to it quite directly. So, but yes. From a personal perspective, really, as a child, as an adult, as a mom, but also as a human rights defender. I think what one sees in a context like South Africa, a country that comes from a background where we've gone through what they call apartheid, we've gone through the experience of oppression, of slavery, where it became normalized to discriminate against the other, to cast the other aside, to judge and treat the other as less than a human. So to unlearn the type of behavior, to unlearn the type of indoctrination, it's going to take a while. I mean, we come from a context and background where we were actually people that were told who you can have a relationship with and not in a relationship with. What type of sexual activity could you engage in? Where could you live and where you should not be able to live? So human relations have, unfortunately, even through law, being such that they are regulated. So it's going to take us some time to unlearn that. And of course, this is not me wanting to excuse the level of hate that we're experiencing. And if you look at the level of GBV or gender-based violence that is subject on women, children, and people that are LGBTI, and even men that are not necessarily even gay themselves, it gives you a sense that we're a country that has so much more to do towards social cohesion, towards unlearning what has become normal and which is violence.
You know, I wanna take it somewhere where I think we also need to pass, because, you know, we did say it in passing, the idea of someone coming out and identifying themselves in this day and age, to say, just as we are working on the legislative element, the prosecutorial element, and the human rights element, but on a social scale, how much support is there that exists for someone who's coming out, who needs that support? You briefly touched on the issue of shelter, but I'm just talking about that counseling, that support, that walking with them, that telling them it's okay to come out and be yourself. I mean, against all these odds that we are speaking about today, but I'm just saying, is there support on that social level for someone who's saying, you know what, I think I'm tired of living a lie, I'd want to come out and identify myself who I am as I see myself, and, you know, I don't know who I'll talk to, where to go, because you do know of a depression line, you might know of a child line, but do we know enough, or do we have a toll-free number, do we have a place that offers support?
So within, or at least through the work of the trust team, there's quite a number of structures that have been set up insofar as being able to access psychosocial services. And a lot of it, unfortunately, relies primarily from the work as led by the Department of Social Development. And not in KZN alone, we have seen all the way to the MEC's office, the visibility of DSD insofar as when incidents is happening, even before they happen, the level of advocacy towards making sure that we talk about systems are put in place towards supporting us. I do also want to highlight the fact that there are structural issues insofar as indicated, being able to access services and even being able to access shelters, but also the psychosocial services. We do not have enough social workers in the province and in the country. We do not have enough psychologists that are able to provide these services to us, at least at prices that we can afford, at least pro bono. So I know there remains a call for help from our end, to say not just the guys from the depression SA type of space, or colleagues that we have within Lifeline, and of course people might be familiar with the 0800-150-150 line as far as responding to GBV. But all of those guys, there's not enough capacity. So yes, there is some help available, but it's just not enough for the amount of issues that tend to come from time to time. And the matter that most time when these happen, it's after hours when most of the social service offices or even psychologists have closed their offices. The Tuzelas, we have quite a limited number of them within the country. I mean, in KZN alone, I think we're counting about 5-6 at most.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good enough for a province as huge as ours. And bearing in mind that we are quite the hot spot when it comes to the visibilization and experience, unfortunately, at this point in time, of what is called hate crimes. So there is help, but it's unfortunate that it is not enough and it is not always there when we need it. So we've relied quite a lot on civil society organizations as partners of the task team and working with the Department of Social Development, and to an extent, the Department of Health, if you consider the partnership with the TCCs, to make sure that the services are as best as possible available to LGBTI.
You know, I'm thinking about, you know, from an occupational health perspective, when we do create buildings or build office buildings and so forth, there needs to be a consideration made for handicapped people to access the building in terms of ramps and making it sure it's wheelchair friendly. So there's this emphasis on access, the ability to access buildings so you can access services, especially with public buildings and so forth. And as we're engaging and having a talk, there's issues of access when we talk about ablution facilities, for instance, public ablution facilities. I mean, we're still on a point where when you go to a public ablution facility, you find a figurine of a female and a figurine of a male. And one will think maybe that, of course, is not very accommodative to a level. And, of course, it does not promote access. Where are we in that issue of access, either from a public facility perspective or social facility perspective? Is there any move in that section wherein making gender-neutral ablution facilities instead? What are we doing in terms of access to things and facilities?
So speaking as able-bodied people.
Yes.
Because at most, the issues that be about structural access has a lot to do with us as able-bodied people than it is for individuals that are perhaps on wheelchair, perhaps not able to see and requiring support. But where one is going is South Africa is a country of quite a difficult people, and it's quite a challenge if you compare us to certain other countries that have sort of or somewhat progressed insofar as those structural barriers are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, having said that, when you look at what scale South Africa is at insofar as the exposure and experience of violence is concerned, it becomes one of those tough ones that is people coming from a LGBTI context could forcefully advocate, and forcefully, not necessarily the right term, but yeah, advocate for unisex type of restrooms when we know very much that what we're competing with is reality, very sad reality in South Africa where violations insofar as gender is concerned are quite high. So it's going to be one of those that in balancing rights, we think quite strategically and be very clear where such might work and where such might not work. We're going to have to be a country that remains in conversation about this and also look at how, as now we have an NSP, National Strategic Plan, responding to gender-based violence, how that in its work in line, in partnership with the National International Strategy, intervention strategy as implemented by the task team and any other strategy that is currently being implemented in the country that speaks to the same issues, how then do we make sure that our collective response is such that it does not put others' rights first to the detriment of others, but that we continuously are trying to balance the scale. So, the long and short of my answer to your question is, for me, it's a tough one, and I don't think within the task team we really have had enough time and space to deal with this bearing in mind that really our priority has been with regards to the reporting, the monitoring, the fast tracking of cases as they relate to hate crime, corrective rape, and GBV.
I think my last question for you would be this one. I've always wondered the work that the Department of Correctional Services does in terms of life under incarceration for LGBTQI members. How is that? Is there some processes in place or some sort of structure that allows one to be incarcerated whilst your human rights are still being respected in incarceration? Well, what's the view of that space there?
Interesting you mentioned that immediately after we were looking at the issue of restrooms.
Yes.
Because, yes, of course, as LGBTI persons, we do find ourselves on the wrong side of the law and having to be apprehended and at best placed under police holding and at worst placed in correctional facility. And really, there is a struggle within that space, and I know that is work, as far as the testing is concerned, that has been very much on our agenda and part of our conversation and forward planning, how we deal with that. But it was, at this level, very much on the lines of making sure that when I'm on the wrong side of the law, when I'm apprehended, when I'm detained, when eventually I'm within the facility, I do not find myself subject to violence because of who I'm placed. Of course, over and above that is the curriculum within correctional services and how that is designed to uplift and change or help me grow to being a better person as an LGBTI. So it's unfortunate. I don't think we've gotten there yet, but I stand to be corrected by my team. But yeah, I don't think we were there yet. We're still very much at the point of what happens to me when I'm on the wrong side of the law and needing to be in a space where, yes, I need to pay my dues, but at the same time where it needs to be very clear that even in that space, I'm still a human being who still has dignity and the right to equality and therefore whose rights need to be protected within that space. And of course then hopefully we'll then also look into curriculum issues. But I think it's an important one that you've mentioned, and I really would want to take it back to my team. Should it be that there's a meeting or two I missed where such issues were engaged with?
I think we are joined by a caller on the line. Caller, good evening and welcome to the program as we wrap up.
Hello.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Fine.
I'm all right. Please proceed with your question or comment as we wrap up. Yep.
Lapha ekhingcwe ixaya e-Richards Bay ngabe yikhona nindawo engama-shelter esingabalekela kuzona singakwazi ukuthi sihambe siyoqasha khona uma sihlukumezeke endenini yethu.
Nonhlanhla, I'll throw this back to you as a provincial task team member. Bayabuza nge-Richards Bay ukuthi ama-shelter status sithini, is there somewhere they can go?
So angixolise provide language sikhulume kakhulu ngesiNgisi. Angithiki ukuthi mhlawumbe ingxoxo yethu izosithinta nesiZulu. But sibonge umlaleli for umbuzo asewubuzile. And just quickly, as bese sigeta tukunaba ancane kukhona ngokwethu namhlanje ukuthi-ke masikhuluma iy'ndaba zama-shelter or iy'ndawo esingahlala kuzona kwethutshana mesizithola sisenyembezi. Unfortunately, asinazo ezibhekene nathi ngqo. But if ukuthi umuntu wesilisa la ekwaZulu Natal ozithole kwi-situation la kukuthi ngempela fanele ubaluleke uyoqasha sami yokwesikhashana, khona bezikhona iy'ndawo eziwu-2 esemaritzburg ningala ezulu lento esikwazi ukuthi sibeke amakhanda ngaphansi kwayo kwesikhashana. But over and above that, unfortunately, akukho okunye. Kunalokho akhona yilabo abhekelene nalabo abasuke bebalekela ukuthi bayahlukunyezwa kwi-relationship or bayahlukunyezwa emakhaya, and at most lezo zindawo sithola ukuthi zibhekelele abantu abayiminyaka yabo zo 18 nangaphansi thina ukuthi ngabe sizothola ukuthi ngempela sinayo indawo ngobani kunalo ucabanga ukuthi ke mabe kuvela into enjengale wena sangamlanda umuntu waka Department of Social Development usonhlala kahle azohlalisana nami nomndeni wami sibonisane ukuthi kona kanephi singakhana kanjani nami ukuthi ngempela kusenzeni ukuthi siyakhana bese ke siyabheka indlela zokuthi wena impilo yakho singayiqala kanjani kabusha usukhiphile ekhaya or in a space la uzithola khona ukuthi awamukelekanga ngenxa yomuntu oyena noma ama-relationship okona. So nje kafushane asinazo but usizo lona liyatholakala ngendlela ezahlukahlukene. Uma kuthi umlaleli nje bebuzile Richards Bay angakwazi ukuthi ngisikhona i-organization esibambisene nayo eseRichards Bay LGBTI ngeza inamba yayo 076-981-1052 ukuthi babhalele nje ku-WhatsApp uxoxisane futhi nabo kangconywana. But bona bebambisene ne-Lifeline Zululand should be able to ukuthi baphinde banikeze inhlahlandlela ogcike ubangconywana ngodaba esikhuluma mangane.
That's okay. I think you would have listened on the radio, and I think at least we can repeat the number, which 076-961-1052.
076-981-1052.
All right. No, excellent. Thank you very much. Nonhlanhla, we've spoken for about an hour or so, really trying to break these issues down into small, bite-sized chunks so that we can all understand and be able to swallow. And I think you did a great job in trying to bring better understanding, raising awareness, and also pushing a bit of advocacy so that we can respect human rights, because at the first and foremost, we are human beings with human rights. And I think that's where everything should start. Thank you so much for the work that you do and the work that you were doing with us today. It was unfortunate we couldn't continue with Slindi Letwala, but do thank you so much for your work and all the best with all your future endeavors. Indeed, thank you so much. I think this is where we come to the end of today's program, where we were focusing on sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, and sex characteristics. And I also got my own schooling. And with that, I think we need to thank all the stations that have participated in this program of tonight, and also thank the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for bringing this program through. And we're coming to you live from the GCIS studios in Pretoria. My name is Sean Murauzi, and this has been a live presentation. Good night.